Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willems, and this episode's guest, Katherine Hudson. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers. This is the podcast where I talk to other science fiction and fantasy writers about their creative process. And I say other because I am myself an author of science fiction and fantasy. And in fact, this very week, this podcast goes live on Sunday, September 13th, 2020. On September 15th, Tuesday, my next book, The Moonlit World, comes out from Daw Books. This is book three in the World Shapers series, which began at the same time as this podcast did in 2018. World Shapers, the series, is set in a labyrinth of shaped worlds, and the shapers of those worlds, people from our world who have the ability to shape worlds and who were discovered here and trained by a mysterious woman called Agrare and then given a world to shape. Now, these shapers live within the worlds that they shape, so it's a lot like the authors that I interview on the podcast living inside the worlds that they shape, some of which they may or may not actually want to live inside, depending on what happens there. In my series, World Shapers, Shauna Keyes is the shaper of a world very much like ours, but she's forgotten that fact. A mysterious stranger shows up and explains to her what's going on when the adversary, sort of a mysterious bad guy, shows up and kills her best friend and starts taking over her world by stealing the knowledge of the shaping of it from her. And she and Carl have to flee that world into the next world, which was book two, the Master of the World, it was called, which was set in a Jules Verne-like world with, you know, airships and submarines and floating islands and all that cool stuff. And then the third book, The Moonlit World, which comes out this week, takes place in a world that I have long described as werewolves and vampires and peasants. Oh my! Because it's a world where there are werewolves and vampires and peasants. And Carl and Shauna have to figure out who shaped this world, gather the knowledge of it, and escape it without getting devoured and or turned into the undead. And that is the goal of Shauna in the series, as she has to gather the knowledge of the shaping of these other worlds and take it to Agrare, who's been wounded and is hiding in her own world somewhere in the labyrinth. And she needs the knowledge of this world brought to her, all these worlds brought to her, so that she can try to keep the labyrinth together and keep the adversary from destroying all of the worlds and their billions of inhabitants. That's the overall premise. I'm looking forward to the release on Tuesday of The Moonlit World, and I hope you'll check it out. And I also hope you'll check out, just a week later, on September 22nd, the ebook release of Shapers of Worlds. Shapers of Worlds is the anthology that features guests from the first year of this podcast. I just got the print copies, Kickstarter backers copies this week, because this anthology was successfully kickstarted earlier this year. The books are gorgeous. And the ebook and the print book, which will be out in November commercially, features new fiction from Shauna McGuire, Tanya Huff, David Weber, Ellie Modisett Jr., DJ Butler, Christopher Rocchio, John C. Wright, me, and Shelley Adina, plus stories by John Scalzi, David Brin, Joe Haldeman, Julie Sherneda, Fonda Lee, Dr. Charles E. Gannon, Gareth L. Powell, Derek Kunskin, and Thorea Dyer. Absolutely wonderful lineup of stories. I think you'll love it. You can pre-order the ebook now on Amazon or any other ebook retailer that you might like to frequent. And the print book is in the works. The commercial release will be out in mid-November. That will start showing up sometime, not too distantly, on the online bookstores as well. And it can also be ordered by any bookstore anywhere. So if you'd like a print copy, one of the places you can get a print copy and an ebook copy is directly from me through shadowpawpress.com. Shadowpaw Press is my own publishing company, and that's who's publishing Shapers of Worlds, and or my online store, edwardwilletshop.com. I also want to mention that I have already started looking ahead to a possible Shapers of Worlds Volume 2. Been talking to my second year guests on this program, and I already have some pretty amazing authors who said they'd be interested in either writing a new story or providing a reprint. They include people like Marie Brennan, Kelly Armstrong, S.M. Sterling, Candace Jane Dorsey, Matthew Hughes. It's going to be just as great a lineup for the second volume. assuming that I can fund it through another Kickstarter in the new year, as for the first volume. So keep an eye out for that. And yes, I will mention it from time to time on this podcast, like every week. All right. Well, that's the opening material, except to say, as I always do, that World Shapers podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. Lots of great podcasters right here in the province of Saskatchewan. That's the opening material, so let's get on to this episode's guest, Catherine Hudson. International best-selling author Catherine Hudson has been writing dark fantasy, sci-fi, and LGBTQ speculative fiction since 2000. With her wildly messed up heroes, excruciating circumstances, impossible decisions, and happily never afters, she's a firm believer in piling on the intense action, showing a little character skin, and never skimping on violent means to bloody ends. That's quite the setup. In addition to writing her own dark and enchanting fiction, Catherine spends the other half of her time as a fiction ghostwriter of almost every genre, as fiction co-editor for Burlington's Mud Season Review, as director of Top Shelf Interviews for Top Shelf Magazine, and is an active member of Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America and the Horror Writers Association. Catherine lives in Colorado with her husband, their young daughter, and their two dogs, Sadie and Bruce Willis. So, Catherine, welcome to the World Shapers.
Thank you so much for having me, Edward. I'm really glad to be here.
Well, I'm very glad to have you. We made the connection through Mickey Mickelson, who's my publicist and has been doing some publicity for you, too. So I've got some really good interviews coming up, thanks to Mickey, so I appreciate his help. I'm going to start the same way I always start, which is kind of a cliche on here. I keep saying I'll put reverb on it. I'm going to take you into the mists of time. Which is, you know, considerably mistier for some of us than others. But anyway, I will go back to when you were growing up and how you got interested in writing. Most of us started as readers. Is that how it started for you? And where did you grow up, for that matter?
Yes. Well, I did actually grow up here in Colorado. We have just recently returned after having lived, you know, in three other states across the country. But I started reading at a very young age. I think I was probably almost three or three, same age as my daughter, and she's reading now too. So it doesn't surprise me. But I've always been an avid reader, and I always loved the escape of hopping into stories that had nothing to do with reality, my own personal life, hence probably my love for writing speculative fiction, sci-fi, fantasy, the whole bit. And I actually started writing when I was 10. I was having this reoccurring nightmare that, you know, it doesn't seem scary at all now, but at the time it was terrifying and aggravating. I was in my favorite movie, which when I was 10 was Fern Gully, and I could not change the ending of that movie, which is the only thing that I didn't like about it. So I kept having this dream that I was in the movie and I should have been able to change it, but I could never change the ending. And it just really, really got me. I've been having this dream for like 2 weeks. And I woke up on my 10th birthday, actually, after having this dream again, and I was just so frustrated and so upset. And then it occurred to me, just suddenly out of nowhere, that I could write the end of the movie if I wanted. Maybe that would get the dreams to stop. I didn't actually write the end, rewrite the ending of Fern Gully, but I dove into my very first attempt at writing any kind of story at all. And over the next, I think 2 years, it turned into something like 300 printed pages of a book about fairies that actually, you know, turned out to be very dark and depressing. And, you know, it set me up for success. And that's where it started.
Well, what were some of the books you were reading that had an impact on you, do you think?
Around that time, I know the only thing that stands out in my mind a lot was The Forgotten Beasts of Eld, and I can't even remember who the author is.
Patricia McKillop.
Thank you so much. Always flips my mind. And then
I read it too.
Okay, good. Well, I love that. I love that. You have a lot of people haven't, or at least people I've spoken to have not read it. And I was also, I think I'd also read all of The Chronicles of Narnia, C.S. Lewis's big giant collection. I'd already read those, and I may have at the time been diving into his Dark Materials series. Is it Philip Pullman?
Philip Pullman.
Yes, thank you. And so, you know, I was already reading things. Oh, I also read Stephen King's It when I was 10 as well. So that, like, probably had a lot to do with it. A little bit of an eclectic reading list, for sure.
Well, a lot of early readers. I mean, I didn't start reading quite as early as you did, but I did learn to read in kindergarten. We had a teacher that wasn't so much teaching us how to read, but was setting us up for it and taught us the sounds of the letters. And I immediately made the connection and said, oh, and I started reading. And I actually skipped,
words, yeah.
I actually skipped the first grade. They put me straight into grade two because I'd already learned how to read.
Very nice.
So, yeah, I was always reading. You know, I'd be reading the kids' stuff, and I liked reading stuff with kids my age in it, obviously. But then I was also reading stuff that was, you know, wildly inappropriate.
Yes. Absolutely.
I remember reading I read The Caine Mutiny when I was about 10, and I was asking my mom some of the words were, and she was going, what are you reading?
That's hilarious. My dad actually gave me his childhood copy of Robinson Crusoe when I turned 10 as well. And I started reading that too. It was just a crazy amount of
all these words and stories and things are going into your head. It's no wonder your first, that's a fairly lengthy thing for your first thing to write, 300 pages of fairy story.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it will never see the light of day, and it will never, nope. I still have it, but it's not being taken back out. But it started me on the process.
So what happened after that? You kept writing on through school and into high school? Or?
I did. I kept, writing. Mostly I'd work on random short stories here and there just because it felt, obviously, you know, as they do, so much easier and faster to finish short stories. and then I started writing. I started writing this dark fantasy, big, gigantic, enormous. It turned out to be altogether when I finished the first draft, it was 250,000 words. And I had finished it at 11:57 on New Year's Eve in 2007. And I had told all of my friends that I wasn't coming out for New Year's or going anywhere. Because I had to finish this book. And I did. I had to finish it before the new year. And I had, you know, written that all through my first 3 years of high school at that point, and during classes as well. Everyone thought I was such a wonderfully attentive student, taking so many notes. but I was writing this book instead. And then that later, you know, once I sat on it for years and years and years, and then had some extensive revisions, that giant first novel became my first two books, the Guinona's Children duology and Daughter of the Dragon and Mother of the Dragon, and that launched my author career as well. So, you know, I wrote them forever ago, but they stuck around.
When you were writing as a young person, were you sharing your writing with your friends? I always ask that because I get differing answers, but it's always interesting to me because I did, and I wonder what other people did.
Oh yeah, I tried as hard as I possibly could to share it with my friends, and unfortunately, I was the only one among my friends who was interested in writing and creative writing and sharing that process and, you know, getting and receiving feedback and probably even reading fantasy and sci-fi at all in any way. So I, you know, a few friends would read it. And the only feedback I ever got was, oh, that's good. I liked it.
Yes, you don't always get very useful feedback from, from your high school chums.
And I definitely push for them to like tell me like what doesn't work, what do you not like. Like I want to hear something, and no one could say anything. So, and then I think eventually they stopped actually reading. Would probably just leave, you know, a manuscript on, I don't know, a table somewhere and never actually read it. But so I got a little bit, but not very much at all.
Did you study formally writing at any point during there? And then when you got to the university level, did you do any formal study of writing?
I did.
And was it helpful?
that's an even better question. I went to the University of Colorado at Boulder for bachelor's in creative writing fiction. And it was a great experience. First, immediately, because I was rejected, like my application for the creative writing fiction program was rejected the first time I applied. And I was like, oh, you got to be kidding me. Because if I'm not going to college for this, I'm not going to college for anything. This is all I want to do. And so that was my first little dose of like, okay, I'm not as great as I think I am. Excellent. I have room for growth. And then I applied again and was accepted with a different short story, which is wonderful. And so, you know, then I went through those undergraduate classes, and, you know, it was all writing short stories. And for our finals, you know, we had to write and complete a full-length novel and then return with, it was either one acceptance letter of any of our short stories, or you know, if we caught an agent's interest by querying, or I think it was something like 15 to 20 rejection letters. So it's like either you get one in and that's your final, or you at least make sure that you are applying and being rejected by.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But you know, it had a lot to do with it, just preparing, I think, you know, budding writers for the process of what comes ahead of time. And this was definitely before self-publishing was very much of an option at all. So, but I did find a lot of things particularly helpful in those classes and my formal creative writing education at the university level. And I think there's one workshop that sticks with me particularly, where I had turned in a short story. It was my week for my story to be workshopped. And then when that arrived, I had written this story just as like I have no inspiration, no motivation. I just this. And I just kind of vomited words onto the page. And I knew it wasn't good. And then when it came time to workshop this story, my classmates just absolutely tore it apart, just ripped a new one in that thing. And I just remember sitting there and being like, yep, yep, I know it's awful. Okay, so that it didn't work. All right. And that was an important experience for me to have, because I hadn't had that I guess aggressive level of critique before. And then it also, you know, I got to kick myself back into gear after that. And then I have always been highly aware of the fact that I can't lower my own expectations for myself and my own writing. And I'm not going to be able to fool anyone by writing something that I know is awful. And that was great. That was a wonderful learning experience. And I got a lot out of, you know, crafting character and natural dialogue. And, you know, then things, of course, that just are always honed over time and with practice, right?
Were you writing the kind of stuff you write now during those courses? And was there any pushback on that? Because certainly when I've talked to some writers, they encounter the, oh, you can't write that crap. We're literary here. Kind of a pushback from some of their instructors.
Right. Yeah. It was very literary centric. And so I didn't write any speculative fiction for the short stories and the assignments. It wasn't, I suppose it was more or less frowned upon. I think perhaps magical realism may have been like as far toward the line, not even across it, but toward the line as was accepted. But I did dive into writing humor too, which was really fun. But no, I wasn't writing any fantasy or sci-fi at that time. Just because I didn't have time to keep writing other things. I was writing all these pieces for my classes, which was great because I was still writing. And that was the point.
Yeah. Well, just, you know, I was a newspaper reporter because I decided as I was heading into college that, well, nobody can make a living as a writer. So not right off the bat anyway. So I decided to do something that would involve writing. And what I found was that, you know, writing 3 features a week and news stories and columns and everything else, because I was working at a weekly where you write everything.
Just
putting words down on paper and, you know, hundreds and thousands of words. It's the practice of putting words together is valuable no matter what kind of words they are, almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. As long as they make sense.
As long as they make sense, yeah. I think they usually did.
Yeah, that's good. I hope so.
Then you talked a little bit about, you know, some of your early books actually then became the ones that got you started on your professional career. How did that all come about? How did you break in?
Ah, yes. Well, so I queried the heck out of the first book in that duology, Daughter of the Dragon, and did more revisions and more querying, and I racked up 115 rejection letters for this first book. And I had, you know, previously been seeing and hearing some stuff from other people about, you know, like, indie publishing is becoming a thing. It's an option. It's something you could do. And I was like, all right, I promised myself that if no one wanted to pick up this book traditionally, and, you know, where I would find an agent and hopefully a publisher, and I was going to exhaust all my other resources and options and like a query to literally everyone in the writer's marketplace who accepted queries from, you know, for fantasy. And then when no one picked it up, I was like, okay, well, I just want to put this book out there. I just want to, you know, I wrote it. I want people to be able to read it. So I went through the indie publishing process, and as a first time indie author, first time indie publisher, I had absolutely no idea what I was doing, and I can 100% admit that, because there was a huge learning curve. And so, you know, some things that I did in the very beginning were, you know, I released books a lot more professionally and with a lot more experience under my belt now. But that first book was really, really well received, and a lot of people loved it, and it's still a favorite, I think, with some of my core readers who stick around and pick up everything that I put out these days still, since, you know, since Daughter of the Dragon came out in 2015. So that has been very cool. And yeah, it has just been a learning process the entire time along the way. And I've, you know, found mentors and guides and have read all the how to's I could find. And, you know, I've also learned so much through ghostwriting and through seeing kind of behind the scenes how things work in the industry with my quite big clients who I go straight for. And I get to, you know, take a peek at their little secret processes and their own formulas for things. And that's been very helpful too. And also, well,
how did the ghostwriting come about? You probably can't say who you ghostwrite for, but, how did that all come about for you? It's interesting. I've done not exactly ghostwriting, but I've done like a house name sort of writing. And it's always, it was an interesting process because I was handed the plot and the characters and it's, and yet you still have to make it work for yourself as the writer. So anyway, how did that come about for you?
I was watching this company for a while who, I guess that they're like a do it for you kind of service for indie authors and handling, you know, ads and reader engagement and like the publication process. And I didn't actually do anything with this company, but they had forwarded a link to this webinar that was about ghostwriting and that, you know, and I knew absolutely nothing about it in the beginning. So I was going in with an open mind. You know, they had a great pitch about like, this is how you make 6 figures a year writing fiction, if that's something you want to do and you don't care about not doing it for yourself. And so I was like, wow, that sounds like, is that really true? I have to see. And so I watched this webinar. And I found out more about what ghostwriting was, and I saw some of these numbers that were coming up for projects, and I just felt this like huge pull to this. It was like, oh my gosh, if I could get paid this much to just write all the time, doesn't matter what it is, just fiction, just and like have everything handed to me, and all I have to do is write it. That sounds literally like the most phenomenal thing, you know. Second, of course, to making tons and tons and tons of money on my own books and being able to write full time just for myself. And so I applied for this mentorship after this webinar, and I didn't, I got accepted after, you know, having sent in writing samples and stuff. But it was one of those, you know, it was a course. And of course, there's a certain amount of investment that would, you know, coming from my part, that had to had to be contributed beforehand, and it was more at the time than I could afford, and so I sent email after email after email, like, I really want into this mentorship, I really want to know how to do this, let's, you know, I tried to haggle and barter and make deals, and it went on for like 3 weeks until finally I was like, all right, this probably isn't going to happen. It's, you know, it's probably not going to happen. And then I got an email saying, you know what, we're willing to do this with you, if we're, you know, for this and this and this, these terms. How does it sound? And I was like, yes, yes. So it paid off. And then I dove into it with both feet. And at that time, my daughter was 7. No. No, no, she was all, I'm so sorry. I sound like a ridiculous person. My daughter was just over 1.5 years old at that time. And so I started this process of diving into the mentorship and then learning how to, you know, navigate freelancing as a ghostwriter. And actually, the person who was leading this mentorship, turned out to act as sort of an agent for me for finding clients and projects directly through him after, you know, the program ended, which is wonderful because then I didn't have to, you know, do the freelancer hustle. And then I just started landing. It's just kind of one big client right after the other. And I don't think I've had a new client for the last, I don't know, 14, 15 months. Which has been really great. So this is a consistent, repetitive thing, and the opportunities just keep opening up, which is really great.
What do you what have you learned from being a ghostwriter that you apply to your own writing?
That is a great question. That I have learned that there's a big difference between what I write for myself under my own name and the type of story that appeals to a much wider audience. I may be a little bit of a specialty writer, I suppose. And, you know, and I've heard that, you know, some people have read my stuff and have said, oh, this is too dark for me. I can't do it. And it's not happy enough. And I can't go there. And I've gotten a few poor reviews because of that as well, which I actually really appreciate because it tells me that, you know, what I'm writing, I am writing very specific, like for a very specific group of people. And so, you know, I've been ghost writing almost in every genre. I know I can't write romance. I tried it once and failed, and that was that. But, you know, everything else, I've learned a lot about the kinds of tropes that consistently need to be fulfilled book after book, series after series, though the characters may change and, you know, the storylines change, obviously, that more people are willing to read and will enjoy, you know, kind of balancing the escapist reading with the reading that, you know, for me personally, I always choose books that have a little more to offer underneath the surface, and I love dark stuff, so that's, you know, that's where I go automatically.
Ever since you were 10, apparently.
Yes, quite. It's been a lifelong love affair with evil. And so I'm actually writing this new dark urban fantasy series, which it's under my own name. I will be publishing the first in that series fairly soon. And it's actually been really interesting for me to take, you know, what I've learned with my ghostwriting work and, you know, writing in someone else's voice and to the tropes that they, that are necessary in the books, that this client publishes, and, kind of picking out those bits and pieces after, you know, 2 years of seeing what makes these books good and what makes people love them and crave more of them, and bringing that into my own little super dark flavor. So this new series is not nearly as dark as I truly love to go, but it does get there. And then it comes right back out again, and it uses, you know, a lot of the tricks and sort of perhaps it's not as angsty maybe as some of the things that I've written, or not as depressing perhaps, but it's been really, really fun to learn what works well for a much wider range of people who are reading to escape real life, and, you know, instead of to dive deeper into real life for, you know, relatable discoveries, I guess I could say. So that's been fun. It's probably been the biggest thing that I've learned. And to not take myself so seriously. I can write a lot of things if I just let it happen, and not try to make it so perfect.
Well, we're going to talk specifically on this podcast about, well, I guess it's two books. Make sure I keep wanting to say Sleepwalker, but it's not Sleepwalker, it's Sleepwater. Sleepwater Beat and Sleepwater Static.
Yeah.
So without spoiling anything, tell us what they're about.
Yes, these are the first two books in the Blue Helix series, which is LGBTQ plus dystopian sci-fi, and also a total mashup, including noir and horror elements, and I've had some readers even categorize it as like urban fantasy, which was not really where I was going.
Well, it's an urban setting, and it's a fantastical story, so there you go.
yeah, you know, there's some supernatural elements to it that, you know, it's, this series is like, well, it's Sleepwater Beat, the first book was. I like to describe it as The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo meets X-Men. And so, you know, that seemed very fitting to me that the entire Blue Helix series revolves around a minority group of people in the world who have developed this supernatural ability to affect people around them physically by storytelling, basically verbal storytelling. So this ability is called the Beat. And so it is kind of like X-Men in a way, where all these people have these abilities. No one really knows how they got them, and they're different for everyone, but it's all with telling stories and speaking. And so the storyline through the whole series follows these people with the Beat ability, and they are part of this organization called Sleepwater, and so it explores how Sleepwater was born and where they're headed into the future. And, you know, they are a minority group of people who are feared by the world and misunderstood and hated and hunted and discriminated against. And that was one of the major points that I wanted to touch on. Even when I first started writing Sleepwater Beat, and had no idea that this was going to be a series, but surprise. and I, you know, I wanted to touch on marginalized communities and kind of take a deeper look at discrimination and bigotry in the broad sense, by looking at it through a lens of, you know, a group of people that doesn't exist in real life. that is,
well, that's what they want, you know, you to think.
right. Very true. They're hiding. And you know, so Sleepwater Beat focused on Leo Tiefler, and she was the main character in book one, and she had more of me poured into her than any other character I've written. And it just because it felt right to the story, which was odd, but I did it. and so I touched on, you know, homelessness and drug addiction and the LGBTQ community and broken homes. And, oh, there's all kinds of deep, dark places, you know, survivors of drug addiction and family issues, I guess. Leave it at that. And so I wanted to bring all these things to light through this really, you know, awesome, fun, amazing story that follows this group Sleepwater, who all have this ability and who are hunted down because of it. And then Sleepwater Static continues that story, but we have a new main character, Bernadette Manning, and she's a minor supporting character in Sleepwater Beat, and then she got her own book for Sleepwater Static, book two. And it was really important to me to dive deep into exploring discrimination when it came to racism and racial injustice, and that is what Sleepwater Static was kind of based around. So it's set, pretty much all of it is set in the American South. And Bernadette is a white woman in her 70s with arthritis. And she's still super incredible and strong and amazing and doesn't take crap from anybody. And we get to see reflections of her past and her relationship with Daryl, who's a black man, and they're in South Carolina. And you know, the difficulties that they faced through growing up in the 60s, 70s, 80s and having a child and being together, and then also seeing them reconnect again, if you will, in their 70s when Bernadette and this group of Sleepwater are being chased across the country and hunted and just looking for kind of a place to settle down for a second and catch a breath. There you have it.
So you obviously have some big themes you want to explore. Did you start with the themes or did you start somewhere else? In other words, where do you get your ideas? It's a bit of a cliche, but it's a legitimate question. And the way this story began is that typical of the way that ideas and the seeds of ideas come to you?
Right. No, the beginning of Sleepwater Beat was completely atypical. 100% absolutely. It started with me writing an experimental short story. I had, just one scene popped into my head of a, teenage girl punching a guy in the face and knocking him over the edge of a frozen waterfall. So I have, fairly violent daydreams as well. and they get written into my books. So I wanted to, I sat with it for a little while with that scene that popped into my head and sort of thinking about it, and then decided that I wanted to try this experimental short story where I wanted to see if I could create a coherent story with scenes that were completely out of chronological order from beginning to end. And it sort of worked. And I got the points across in the story, but it wasn't finished. And I had actually workshopped it with the writers group I was a part of in Charleston, South Carolina, when I lived there with my husband. And they were so enthralled by what I had started in this short story that they asked so many questions and just opened up so many doors and told me that they wanted to see more and that it had to be a book. And I was like, wow, okay, I agree with you. and then I took 2 years to rip apart that short story and decide what I wanted to keep and what I wanted to change and turn it into, 105,000 words. So that was rough. Not at all the way I normally do things, but it turned out very well. But most of my ideas do come from a dream or a random daydream of something that I think would be very cool.
So you tend to start you tend to start with an image then.
I do start with an image, and then I kind of let it hang out in my head for 6 months. And see what happens. And then I start writing.
Well, what does your planning process look like? Do you do a detailed outline, or are you more of a let's start writing and see what happens? Again, with the Sleepwater books, but then also since they seem a little different, more typically.
Mm-hmm. So I don't do detailed outlines at all. I've tried hoping that would solidify my writing process a little more, but I have realized that when I outline in detail, I get bored. It feels like I've already tried to figure out the whole story, and then I lose the excitement. Because the best part for me, where I have the most fun, is when I'm just writing and I'm in the zone and I'm going, and all the pieces come together, just like, I don't know, like machinery. it's so much fun to see, the characters that I thought would be one thing turn into something completely different and go down paths that I didn't expect. And I solve the mysteries that I create in the beginning as I'm writing them. So I never know what's going to happen. I probably right now, I'm somewhere in between in the hybrid range. I will write beats for my books. And I definitely always do this for my ghostwriting work because it enables me to keep up my ridiculous speed with writing those projects. And And that's, you know, anywhere from 4,000 to 8,000 words of just summary about the whole plot of the book. And it has all the big moments and big reveals in it. And then I will just write from there, and I get to fill in all the extra space. And that is what works best for me, I've found.
Yeah, writing is weird because in a way it's a very conscious act. You're sitting there typing and putting words, and yet there's this huge unconscious thing going on behind the words that are coming out, where your brain is, and you have no, you know, it's inside your head, and yet somehow you're not really part of the process, it feels like sometimes.
Right, yeah, it's not, or it maybe it's just not in my head at all. It's just going through me somehow. Yeah, and I, you know, I a lot of the time I will go back and, you know, look at something I've written a week before and not recognize it. Like, wow, I don't remember writing this part.
Yeah, when I look back at older stuff I've written, I sometimes have that. It's, well, that's not bad, but I don't actually remember doing it. But
right, it's very strange. It's very strange.
Well, I mentioned that, you know, love it. Sitting and typing, is that actually, I presume that's how you work and you're not a parchment under a tree with a quill pen?
Oh, no. No, I'm not. I just got a brand new desktop set up in my office. We moved almost 2 months ago now from Vermont, so everything kind of had a major rehaul, but I sit and type, and I do, you know, I take breaks during the day, stand up, move around, get my body realigned after sitting.
Do you tend to just work at home, or do you ever go out and for a change of scenery?
I just work at home. I used to be able, when I was in college, I could write anywhere as long as I had headphones in. And I don't know if I'm entering more of that, you know, like writer stereotype, but I have gotten significantly more anxious in public as I've gotten older.
It's not like people look over your shoulders and
I know
critique as you write.
I know. I think maybe part of that is also because I type so fast. I type about 130 words a minute when I'm transcribing something, or, you know, I don't have to think. And so I type faster than I think when I'm writing. And that I get weird about it when any of my family members say that they heard me typing. So I stay home.
I think I was, at least I used to be at about 110 words a minute. And it's like people look at you funny when you're.
They do. They're like, are you writing real words? Yes.
I wear out a lot of keyboards. My keyboards wear out really fast. But
yes.
I also learned on a manual typewriter. So I think I hit the keys harder than is actually required on a computer.
That would do it.
Do you write sequentially then once you start writing? Or is there a lot of threading and going back and filling in scenes and.
I have to write sequentially. The only time I didn't do that was when I wrote Sleepwater Beat, because I was pulling these.
Like part of the short story.
Yeah, it was major surgery and it was bloody and awful and it took me 2 years. And I don't like that. So, I start at the beginning and I just keep going and I push through. And sometimes, you know, sometimes I'll come across something where I realize that, oh, this tiny little detail needs to be, you know, changed in a thread from the beginning. And I'll go back. And, you know, that happens more towards the end, or I'll make a note as I'm writing to go back and do that. And afterwards with, you know, my own revisions and edits before it sees my editor. I don't think I could write non-sequentially now after having done it this way for so long, this much.
I've always been start at the beginning and go to the end and then go back and fix things up. And speaking of that, what does your revision process look like? And do you use, do you have beta readers or even alpha readers at some point that pitch in, or how does that all work for you? And when you are revising, what's the kind of things you find having to revise?
All good questions. I think I'll start with when I'm like sitting down and writing any book, the most important thing for me is to, of course, you can have a book until it's finished. So to get to the end, right? Just sit down and write all the way straight through and get to the end. And so when I am writing and I get in that zone, I don't want to break it up by having to do research for like very, very specific things. I don't want to break it up by having to, you know, go back into other books or other notes and find names or places, you know, so I will leave those to be found details in brackets. So, you know, typing away. I don't remember this character's name. And I'll just put in brackets, girl one, or, you know, whatever. And then, and that enables me to get the words down so much faster. And I'll leave notes for myself too, with comments and margins, like go back and check if this is a thing. And then when I, you know, write the last words, then I go back through, and I search for all of the instances of brackets that I placed, and then I will do the necessary research, and I will, either make up names that I needed or places that I needed, or go back and find them, and I'll fill in all of those details at the end. That's the first step for me, and that just makes the writing process for me so much faster, and it also doesn't break up my flow, you know, and like getting really into an intense scene, but I can't remember the name of that kind of gun that he had, so you know, I don't want to go fall through the rabbit hole of internet.
Yeah, that's very easy to
research,
do.
Yeah. Right, yeah. So
you're looking up a type of gun, and the next thing you know, it's 17th century silver mining in Asia, and you don't remember how you got there.
Exactly. But those are how the conversations with my dad go, like just by speaking to each other. So I don't need to do that when I'm writing. And so I'll go back through that, and then, you know, while I'm reading through and filling in the brackets as well, I'm also doing as much proofreading as I can, you know. And I, before I was writing full time, I was editing full time, and I've been doing that for, I stopped last November, so like 7 years, 8 years, and so I would like to think that I catch most typos and proofreading errors, but I know that I absolutely do not catch all of them. So I do have an editor as well, and she's amazing. I do have a few alpha readers. I've got about four or five who are completely thrilled to read anything and everything I send them. And with previous books, that has helped me stay excited and inspired and on track with the story. When I get feedback from these alpha readers, and they're telling me like, oh, I love this part. I can't wait to see what happens next. Like, I think it's this, la la la. And so I sit in my corner and, you know, have an evil grin, just like, well, you have no idea what's coming next, and I'm so excited. And then that helps me stay there. And I don't know if I've ever used beta readers. And I think that is because I trust my editor quite a bit, and my alpha readers give me enough feedback during the process that, I don't know, I guess I just haven't felt the need to use beta readers. I have used sensitivity readers, though, which was super important for me, especially with Sleepwater Static, because I was, you know, the closest I could write to anyone who experiences racial injustice in this country and anywhere in the world, was from a white woman's perspective. And it's important to, sensitivity readers are so, so important to make sure that we're not, you know, perpetuating harmful stereotypes and just getting things plain wrong. And that was an incredible experience as well. And as far as I heard from her, I hadn't gotten anything wrong.
It's always nice to hear.
Yes, it is. And then that's about it. You know, I have advanced readers when I'm, you know, before a book's publication, and that's the process.
I've never used beta readers mainly because I just never had any to speak of. So.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The first person that sees it usually is my editor. So, which brings us to yes. the editing process. Yes. What sorts of things do you use the same editor all the time? And because I presume you're hiring an editor since this yes. is independently published.
Yes.
Have you always used the same editor or have you used different editors? What sorts of things do they come back with you?
Yeah, I have had a few different editors. The editor I have now, she's so phenomenal and the best I've ever had. And she edits like I did when I was editing. So I
one would think you'd like that. But,
yes, absolutely. I'm a bit full of myself. but I, you know, some... the most that I get back beyond proofreading is usually, you know, like, this sentence is extremely convoluted and I have no idea what you were trying to say. So, and those pop up every once in a while when I, you know.
So it's more...
I'm sorry?
It's more line editing than you're not getting big structural changes suggested or anything like that?
Correct. I have been fortunate enough to not have... received suggestions for huge structural edits and changes. And I like to give credit for that to the fact that I spent so many years editing other people's manuscripts as well. And that helped me develop, you know, of course, along with all the reading for fun that I do, editing helped me develop kind of an ingrained understanding of, you know, genre elements and the rhythm and pacing of writing these stories. And so I've never really had to do overhauls like that beyond my first book. And that had a lot of work put into it.
Yeah, I've done quite a bit of editing and mentoring and writer in residence kind of work. And mm-hmm. Yeah, I find that it's really very easy to see flaws in other people's work, and it does help you. It does help you then eventually to pull yourself out of your own and say, well, you know, I did the same thing here. And actually one of the things of being a writer in residence, and, you know, I'll tell people, you know, you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that. And then I think, you know, if they look back in that book I wrote, I'm pretty sure I did that.
Whoops. Yeah.
But it is very helpful, I find.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, we're getting close to the end here. It's time for the more reverb, big philosophical questions, which is, I don't know how big they are or how philosophical they are, but basically it boils down to why. Why do you write this stuff? Why do you write it all? Why do you write this stuff, this kind of fantastical stuff? And why do you think anybody does? Why do we tell stories? So kind of three questions, I guess.
Excellent. Yes. So why do I write on a general scale? It's gotten to the point now where I write because I literally have to. And if I go longer than, 36 hours without writing any fiction at all, I get itchy and sweaty and irritable.
So it's an addiction.
It is. It, you know, I will openly admit it. It is the best addiction I've had. we're good to go. But yeah, no, it is. My husband has commented multiple times, you know, on if you know, I'm having a rough day and he'll ask me, have you written today? And more often than not, the answer is no. So I've learned to just accept the fact that I can't take too much time away from writing. It's just become so much of a part of me, and I am so fortunate enough to be able to say that my greatest passion is now, you know, my full-time job. Mm-hmm. And that's incredible. And so why do I write what I write? And I'll go ahead and say this, you know, what I write being dark fiction in general, just dark stuff. And, you know, I I was asked, someone asked me a while ago, if writing what I write is a way for me to like process my own past pain or get a better understanding of certain concepts or ideas about the world. And I realized that it was a great realization to have in trying to answer this question, is that I don't like, I do write for me physically, like I have to, it is an addiction, but the content that I write isn't for me in regards to, you know, working through past pain or trauma or realizations. It's cathartic, but it's not therapeutic, I guess I could say. But I do write with the intention every single time of helping other people access their ability to work through their own stuff and to better understand concepts and ideas that they may be struggling with, and to frame a lot of topics and subjects and issues, a lot of social issues in the Blue Helix series, to frame them in a way that is more accessible to other people who may not otherwise have been open to discussing or reading or even thinking about these things, or who may have never even had the opportunity to consider these discussions from a different perspective or a different angle. So I find that particularly easy to do in dark fiction, because I can really take the characters and the story and the readers just down. Just and maybe, you know, maybe that's cruel of me. But I know that I like it, that, to see that as a reader. And I know I'm not the only one.
Well, clearly not, because you have lots of readers.
Right, yeah. So that's great. So I write the way I enjoy as well. And I write to go really, really into those deep, deep, dark places to then better illuminate, you know, the hope and the possibility and potential for more. And, you know, one of my firm beliefs in my own life and in writing being that our mistakes and the poor decisions that we make in life don't define who we are or what we're capable of becoming after the fact. So that's why I write these things. And why does anyone write? It's storytelling.
Why do human beings do this?
Yeah. Well, because it's so much fun. I mean, that's just how we learn about the world, right? That's how it's always been for humans, learning about the world and teaching each other about the world through story. And then, you know, connecting with each other. It's sometimes it feels a lot easier and even potentially a lot more fulfilling to connect with characters than with real people. And yeah, I think that's probably the end of my answer, to learn about the world and each other and to connect and to form those bonds and understand one another. Story is completely universal. Maybe not the content or the characters where it goes, but telling story applies to everyone.
Seems like a good answer to me.
Excellent.
Well, we'll just wrap up here first with, what are you working on now? You mentioned the new urban fantasy, dark urban fantasy series.
Yes, that is, the Witching Vault. It's book one of Accessory to Magic. That'll be out fairly soon, next couple months, I think.
And anything else to mention? In upcoming projects.
I'll have another first in a a super very, very dark, darker than anything I've ever done, LGBTQ plus dark fantasy series. That's Imlok Fractured. It's the first book in Vessel Broken. And that is, I'm working on two very different projects, but that one is dark and gruesome and just, it has a huge occult influence and I'm so excited about it. So that is slated to be at the end of November this year as well.
And where can people find you online so they can keep up with all of this stuff that you're doing?
Of course, my website is katherinehudsonfiction.com. And
you should probably spell your name because it's...
Yes, it is very different. That's K-A-T-H-R-I-N Hudson, H-U-T-S-O-N, fiction.com. If there are E's in there at all, it's wrong. And I am probably the most active on Facebook. My author page there is Katherine Hudson Fiction. And I'm also Katherine Hudson Fiction on Instagram. And on Twitter as Exquisitely Dark.
Seems appropriate. All right. Well, thanks so much for being on the World Shapers, Katherine. I enjoyed that. I hope you did too.
I sure did. Thank you so much for having me.
So thanks again to Katherine Hudson for being a guest on The World Shapers. That was a great conversation. I certainly enjoyed it, and I hope you did too. She's a very cheerful person to talk to for writing such dark fiction. I just want to remind you that The World Shapers is, of course, online at theworldshapers.com. You can also find it on Facebook at The World Shapers, and you can find it on Twitter at The World Shapers. You can find me online at edwardwillett.com, two T's on Willett, W-I-L-L-E-T-T. You can find me on Twitter at ewillett. You can find me on Instagram at edwardwillettauthor, trying to do more on Instagram. I'm not very good at it. And you can find me on Facebook at edward.willett. Want to remind you again about the Shapers of Worlds anthology. The ebook will become available on September 22nd. Great lineup of authors. And of course, I've read these stories multiple times now, and I still enjoy them. I must have read them all 10 times by now between the editing and the layout and the proofing and all of that. Still love every one of them, and I think you will too. So check that out on Amazon or your favorite ebook retailer. You can pre-order it now. And if you're hearing this after September 22nd, you can go straight ahead and buy it. The print version, the commercial print release, will be coming out in mid-November. And again, that will be available everywhere. And that's through my own publishing company, Shadow Paw Press, which is at shadowpawpress.com. If you're interested in getting autographed copies of any books of mine, you can check out edwardwillettshop.com, my online store, where I offer all of that sort of thing. And I hope you will come back for the future episodes of The World Shapers. They'll be coming probably mostly weekly again for a little while as I support the release of the new book, and also because I have a great backlog of interviews, including, who have I got? I've got R.B. Limburg, I've got Kat Rambo, Casey Azell, Griffin Barber, I'm talking to James Morrow, I'm talking to Cory Doctorow. So that's a pretty great lineup already. And there's more in the works or already confirmed just a little further down the road. So keep coming back to The World Shapers and continue to enjoy these conversations with the authors who have created the worlds and characters that we have so much enjoyed visiting and having adventures with over the years. That's it for this time. Bye for now.